She could imagine that the mountain's peak had once been more squared than pointed, and that one corner of that square had sheared off and tumbled all this way to rest in the vale. "The Godstone," Taniel said, voicing the same conclusion that Laura had just reached. "It was up there?"
"It was, yes," Prime answered.
He looked at them sullenly, scowling at the gloves that Taniel still held in his hands.
"You claim that you're here to destroy it. But it can't be destroyed. I've spent the last 5 years trying to figure out how to do so, and came up with nothing."
"Have you actually tried to destroy it?" Laura asked. "Or have you been studying it to further your own power?"
"I must study it to learn its weaknesses," Prime sniffed. "I have never been after power, my dear Laura. I only seek knowledge."
Laura looked at Taniel. "You remember what Beau likes to say about that?"
"Knowledge is power," Taniel quoted,
giving Prime a sallow smile. Without his gloves, Prime looked like nothing more than an overweight, cranky old man. He scowled at them both, then shook his head.
"You cannot destroy it," he repeated. "I don't believe it can be done."
Laura thought about all the black powder they had piled around the Godstone in Landfall, only for it to cause not even a scratch.
"We'll see. Take us to the damn thing."
Prime scoffed.
"You think you're so smart, but you can't even see that which is in front of you. Dismount and take 3 steps forward."
Laura did as instructed, feeling outward with her sorcerer's senses for an illusion, or a trap, or anything. She could sense nothing, but as she took that 3rd step, her vision seemed to shift. It happened so suddenly that it made her dizzy, forcing her to fall against a nearby boulder.
"Laura!"
Taniel called. She waved him off and felt her eyes widen as she took in this new perspective. The slope of old rubble was no longer there, but rather cleared away from her to the base of the mountain, to create a flat work area upon which there was a small cabin, an outhouse, and a canvas canopy covering an obelisk that looked exactly like the one in Landfall. Her breath caught in her throat, and the sight of the thing gave her a sense of foreboding that she hadn't felt since the end of the Adrankes War. Her chest was tight, her vision blurry. This stone, this thing that had eluded her for the last month, was suddenly here, right in front of her face, and she was speechless. The obelisk lay on its side. It was not as large as the one in Landfall. Eyeing the dimensions, she guessed it to be around 30 feet long and less than 4 feet wide, tapering at the end. It was covered in ancient script that had been cleaned meticulously of all dirt and grit, and it was made of a light grey limestone that made Flora wonder if it was cut from the same stone as its larger twin back in Landfall. Taniel and Prime joined them. Taniel did not seem as affected by the sight of the thing as she had been, though his breath did grow short. Prime merely scowled at it, like a man returning to a hated live-in relative.
"So, they've found you, eh?"
The voice made both Laura and Taniel whirl, drawing their pistols. A woman had stepped out of the cabin and stood by the doorway, her arms crossed. She looked to be in her late 30s, a slim woman of medium height with a shaved head and an old scar that lifted the corner of her lip and crossed her cheek to her temple. Her arms ended in strange gloves that, upon closer examination, were unmoving bronze hands held in place by leather straps. Laura had never met this woman, but she knew exactly who she was from Borbador's stories. She was another Predii, personally responsible for the summoning of Kresimir during the Adrankes War. If Bo was correct, she was as much a catalyst of the war as Field Marshal Tanis. Flora was not happy to see her.
"Hello, Juline," Taniel said, lowering his pistol.
"Too short," Juline purred. "It feels like we were hanging from Kresimir's ropes together just yesterday. How have you been?"
Taniel seemed neither perturbed nor particularly surprised to find Juline here. Flora was both, and she kept her pistol raised for several seconds after Taniel had put his away.
"That was 10 years ago," Taniel said.
"When you've been alive as long as I have, Two Shot, a decade feels like nothing more than a long weekend."
Juline's gaze felt of Flora, and she pursed her lips.
"I told Prime he should have killed you the moment he spotted you in town. But he's a damned coward. What do you call yourself, Prime? A pacifist?"
"I went to finish her off," Prime snapped. "But this one showed up."
Juline took two steps toward Taniel, her nostrils flaring and her eyes narrowing.
"Your blood witch is getting stronger," she said. "I can barely see the wards protecting you."
She let out a sudden, half-mad, barking laugh.
"Bad luck for you, Prime. You finally get up the guts to kill someone, and the one powder mage in the world who can stop you happens to be about."
Flora looked from Prime to Juline.
"Some warning that you weren't alone would have been nice," she told Prime.
"You didn't ask," he responded.
Juline held up her metal hands.
"I may be near immortal, but I'm not much of a threat. I still can't touch the Elves."
"That only makes you slightly less dangerous," Taniel said.
His casual manner was betrayed by the tension Flora could see in his arms and the intensity of his gaze, like a dog with hackles raised. Flora took a half step back. If this came to a fight, she was so badly outclassed that it was almost laughable. Taniel would be on his own against these two.
"We're here to destroy the Godstone,"
Flora interjected. All eyes snapped to her. Juline turned her head to one side.
"You... what?"
"You heard me."
"I heard you. I just don't believe you. If you cornered Prime, you obviously know what the Godstones do. And if you know, then you have no intention of destroying them. Mortals don't give up that kind of power."
The wild look in Juline's eyes was suddenly gone, replaced by a focused gaze and a very distinct air of distrust.
"She's not lying," Taniel said quietly. "Both Lindert and the Dionys are looking for the damn thing. We intend on reducing it to rubble before either of them can reach it."
"You can't destroy it,"
Prime insisted once again.
"It's too powerful. Kresimir made these things to last until long after all life on this planet is extinct. I can't even pick apart the simplest of the wards surrounding it, and I've been doing this for millennia."
Prime's voice rose in crescendo, and Flora wondered if he truly had been trying to destroy the stone. He sounded frustrated as pitch that even his powerful sorcery paled next to that of a god who'd been dead for a decade. Juline had grown quiet, returning to her place in the doorway and watching Flora and Taniel warily.
"This is the work of a god," she said. "You would destroy it just to keep it out of the hands of others?"
"I would destroy it either way,"
Flora said, forcing down her fear and fixing Juline with a look that dared her to question her resolve. Taniel stepped between them, waving his hand in front of Juline's face.
"Everyone should calm down. If I'm not mistaken, and unless the two of you are lying through your teeth, we should all be on the same side.
We don't want the Godstone to fall into the hands of any of the local powers. Hence, it should be destroyed. Flora stared at Juline until the Predi finally looked away with a sigh.
Agreed,
Juline said.
Agreed,
Flora echoed. Prime still looked uncertain.
How do you propose we destroy it?
Taniel looked at Flora, and she suddenly felt foolish for her belief that the invention of a gunpowder maker from Adipest could do what thousands of years of sorcerer's knowledge could not.
I intend on blowing it up.
We tried that already years ago, Juline said. We piled several carts worth of powder barrels on it and lit the fuse. It didn't do anything but cause a second landslide that we had to clear away.
And we tried it on the Godstone in Landfall, Taniel said.
So why, Juline said with more than a hint of disdain, do you think you can blow it up?
Flora remained silent, suddenly feeling overwhelmed and fearful.
We have to try, she finally said. If we cannot destroy it, then we'll haul the thing to the coast, put it on a ship, and sink it to the bottom of the sea.
And you expect to be able to do that with Dionysus and Patrastan armies crawling all over the countryside?
Prime demanded.
With your help, we could.
Juline scoffed again.
Don't look at us. I'm useless without my hands, and this coward might as well be. He'd rather pick up and run than raise his hands to cause bloodshed.
Prime's lip curled, but he did not dispute the claim. Flora looked to Taniel for reassurance, but he seemed just as uncertain as she felt. His brow furrowed. He walked to the Godstone and ran his gloved fingers along the runes, shuddering visibly.
I should have brought Carpole,
she heard him mutter. Louder, he said.
Like Flora said, we have to try.
It'll be a waste of gunpowder, Juline stated.
We're not using powder, Flora responded, heading over to a rock and sitting down where she could watch the entrance to the valley. She ignored the others, taking the time to close her eyes and meditate. It was almost 3 hours until a convoy of wagons finally appeared, with Flering sitting in the foremost one. She said something to Bert's guards, money changed hands, and she continued on through the pass. Flora went down to meet her and show her the way to the hidden Godstone.
Get working right away. We've got one shot at this, and then if it doesn't work, we'll have to figure out another plan.
Flering leaned down from the lip of the wagon.
I'll get to work, she said, but you might want to head into Yellow Creek.
Why?
Because 400 rifle jacks just showed up outside the town, and Bert is getting mighty nervous.
Flora thought of the destruction and the rumours that must be swirling about her fight with the other powder mage. She then considered what Olam would do if he assumed her dead at the hands of a bunch of frontier ruffians.
"Get started on the stone!"
she shouted into her shoulder, sprinting for her horse.
"I've got to stop a slaughter!"
Chapter 55 Flora spotted her soldiers from the entrance to Nighttime Vale. They'd taken up a position just on the edge of the town, where they'd formed into two imposing ranks. Rifles were still shoulders, which was a good sign, but she knew better than anyone how quickly the riflejacks could open fire from a ready position. She wasn't able to see what they were up against until she was almost upon them. Galloping down the main avenue, she steered her horse through toppled carts across bloody cobbles, the aftermath of the fighting between Jezzy's and Bert's gangs, and arrived to find about 300 hired guns and prospectors strung out across rooftops, shop fronts, and barricaded roads. There were about 30 yards between the riflejacks and the city's would-be defenders. The riflejacks had the numbers and the training, but the defenders held the high defensive positions. If this went south, it would go very poorly for both sides. Flora leapt from the saddle and crossed a short barricade where Bert and Olam stood facing each other in the open space between the two forces.
Wait!
Olam looked up with a surprised expression that passed quickly to relief and then stoicism. Bert let out a heavy sigh and gestured to Flora as she arrived.
See? Bert said. I told you she was fine the last time I saw her.
Flora remembered lying in the dirt, face down, after her duel with Noan.
Fine seemed like a stretch, but she let it pass. Stand down, she ordered, both of you.
Olam regarded Bert with a long, thoughtful look, then swept his gaze across the assembled defenders.
We'll stand down when they stand down.
Flora swore under her breath and turned to Bert. This doesn't have to escalate.
I'd really rather it not, Bert replied coolly. The colonel here was just informing me that he would take apart Yellow Creek stick by stick to find you. I told him that was entirely unnecessary. You and I had a deal.
And it still stands, right? Flora fixed Bert with a long, hard look.
It still stands.
Bert gestured to the city. Thanks to you and one of Jesse's men getting trigger-happy, this town belongs to me. He scowled at Flora, taking a step back to examine her shoulder and back.
The last time I saw you, you'd been shot.
Shot? Olam echoed. I thought you said she was fine.
But fine-ish.
Long story. Flora cut Bert off before he could say anything else. But everyone needs to back off before one of your men loses their nerve and this turns into a pitched battle. Olam, order the riflejacks to fall back. Bert, will a half mile be sufficient to cool everyone's temper?
It will.
Bert gave a magnanimous smile.
In the meantime, would you join me for a drink? I think the three of us need to talk. Now.
You don't remember me, do you?
Flora took a whiskey from Bert and glanced at Olam, uncertain. They sat around Bert's desk in the office above his brothel. The building was empty except for the three of them, everyone else putting out fires, sifting through the ashes, or fighting over Jesse's unguarded claims. Flora wondered why Bert wasn't out there overseeing the whole thing.
Have we met before?
Bert offered Olam a cigarette and took his own seat, letting out a soft laugh.
We have. About 12 years ago.
I only first came to Fatrasta a couple years back, Flora said with some confusion.
But that doesn't mean I haven't been to Adro.
Flora frowned. Palo were quite rare in the Nine. A decade ago, they were still considered mysterious savages by polite society.
When?
Gilman University, Bert said.
Flora leaned forward, squinting at Bert's face. She searched her memory for a few moments before locking onto something.
I did meet a Palo. My first year. I don't remember his name, but...
She trailed off. Occasionally, a wealthy Palo chieftain would send a favored child to the Nine to get a Cressian education. Sometimes a whole tribe would pool their wealth to do the same. Flora remembered one of the former, a boy, quite young, with an optimistic face, who'd paraded around in frontier buckskins and spoken Adran with an accent so bad it was laughable. She tried to reconcile that boy with the suave frontier capitalist sitting across from her. Bert grinned, watching her face.
You do remember.
Your name wasn't Bert. I would have remembered that.
No.
Bert looked up as if searching his memory.
I don't even remember what I went by.
Something unpronounceable.
So you weren't really a chieftain's son? Laura asked. That, more or less, was true. Most of the details were either foggy or outright lies.
Olam stood with an unlit cigarette between his fingers.
Why the deception?
We'll get to that, Bert said, lighting a cigar before tossing Olam a box of matches. First, you should know that both Lindet and the Dionys know that you're here, and why you've come. Lindet's 2nd Field Army was wiped out in 3 successive battles a couple of weeks back, so she's in no position to send anyone after you. The Dionys, however, have 5 brigades on your tail. I'm guessing they'll be here in 4 days.
Laura stared open-mouthed at Bert. Olam scoffed.
You couldn't possibly know all that.
I do, Bert said without a trace of smugness. Lindet thinks she runs the messenger service along the mountains, and she does pay for most of it, but it's staffed by my people. The information carried along it reaches me before it reaches her. You, he said, pointing to Vlora, were outed by her spies about the same time the Dionys destroyed the 2nd Army.
You could have warned me.
It wasn't convenient at the time, Bert said with an apologetic smile. But it is now, and you're being warned.
Vlora tried to read Bert's face, attempting to come away with any real impression of the man. He was a blank slate, returning her gaze with a coolness that bordered on unsettling.
So you know why we're here?
I assume I do. You're looking for the Godstone.
Flora shared a glance with Olam before nodding slowly.
You're not a frontier capitalist, are you?
Oh, I'm very much a frontier capitalist, Bert responded, looking somewhat hurt. I've gotten to be filthy rich working this town.
He gave Laura a lopsided smile.
But you're right. I'm not just a prospector.
Laura remembered her conversations with Taniel and his search for a contact with the Palo Nation.
You're with the Palo Nation?
I'm impressed you've heard of it.
A friend warned me.
Bert snorted.
You mean Taniel Two-Shot?
He scratched his head vigorously, squinting at Vlora through one eye until he was done.
I'll be honest, I don't really know what to do with him. Letting him sit in that prison for the last 3 weeks was the best decision I've made in years. I do not like someone like him running around unchecked.
How did you know he'd stay?
Because he's a good man. We've met on several occasions, actually, which was another reason I didn't want him to see me before I was ready.
Are there any of our secrets you don't know? Olam asked.
Bert
pulled a wry face and leaned forward, spreading his arms across his desk.
A quick history lesson, my friends, and listen carefully, because only a handful of Cressians have ever heard it. 50 years ago, my grandfather ruled a mid-sized tribe in what you would call the Fatrastan Wilds. At the time, he'd managed to unite dozens of tribes into a sort of loose coalition, not one of which had ever made contact with a Cressian. Until, that is, a young explorer arrived and made friends with my grandfather. The explorer wound up marrying one of his daughters. My mother.
You're not fully Palo?
Vlora asked in surprise.
I'm half Adran, Bert said with a smile. But I don't look it.
He continued with his story.
My father was something of a Fatrastophile. He loved everything about this continent, and colonial expansion was one of the few things that I've ever seen him get worked up about. Together with my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, and my mother, he began to make a plan for the future of his tribe, to protect them from the Cressian encroachment. Geography was our ally.
Without inside knowledge, the Iron Hook Mountains are very difficult to cross, and the wilds beyond them are vast. For 50 years, no one has questioned the fact that Cressian explorers rarely return from their expeditions north. And for 50 years, no one in the Nine has questioned the wealthy, eccentric savages sent to learn at Cressian universities. Oh, you've gawked and laughed, but never thought twice. And during that time, we learned.
Bert stopped, cleared his throat.
I've gone on too long. So, here is a better summary. Beginning with my grandfather, the Palo Nation has studied you without being studied back. We have co-opted the best parts of your civilization. The tribes were united, the hereditary chieftain system replaced with democracy. We have become the thing that Lindet and all the rest of the colonial powers fear the most. Natives who have modernized before we could be crushed underfoot.
A long silence hung in the air, and Bert took advantage of it to relight his cigar. He finished his tale with a measure of emotion, but it disappeared back into tranquillity as he puffed up a storm of cigar smoke.
"Why are you telling us this?" Valora asked.
Bert pointed his cigar at her.
"Because I'm laying all my cards on the table. Because the Palo Nation won't remain hidden forever. And I, if you'll remember, am half Adran. I quite like Adro. It is the only democracy in the Nine, and I would like very much to lay the groundwork of an alliance."
Flora felt like she'd been punched in the face. This was not what she'd expected when she came here looking for the Godstones, not even in the slightest. Taniel's warnings about the Palo Nation were, in retrospect, not emphatic enough.
"I think that our politicians would be amenable to the idea. But I'm not one of them."
"You're a damned war hero, an Adran general, and a member of the Republic Cabal.
I can think of perhaps 5 people who would be more advantageous to have this conversation with. None of them are here, and none of them have quite your reputation for civility."
"I see. Consider me intrigued. But there are plenty of things to worry about before a formal alliance. Where do the Godstones come into this? Or the Dionys, for that matter?"
"The Dionys," Bert repeated, pulling a sour face. "They're one of the reasons we're having this conversation. If they win this war, they won't be satisfied with tall tales from over the mountains. They will explore north, in force. And they will do so with far more violence and organization than Lindet can manage. For all her intelligence, she's been holding together a house of cards by sheer willpower, and has had no interest in pursuing rumors of our existence. I'm not convinced the Dionys will feel the same way."
"And the Godstone?"
Bert frowned at Olam, then at Vlora. "We are a secular society. We have destroyed our idols, forgotten our gods, and we are better for it. My spies tell me that you and Lindet fell out because you wanted to destroy the stone, so I say this. By all means, destroy it. My government wants nothing to do with the damn thing. If we could have found it, we would have already removed it to the farthest reaches of our territory just to keep it out of Lindet's hands."
Something must have shown in Flora's face, because Bert lifted an eyebrow.
"You've found it, haven't you?"
"And we're working toward destroying it," Flora replied.
"Excellent!"
Bert stood up, clapping his hands together.
"Can you do it before the Dionys arrive?"
"We hope so," Flora said hesitantly.
"You have 4 days.
"Actually, we only have 2.
We have to destroy it, then get out of here before the Dionys arrive. The Dionys have instructions to take my head."
Why? Bert asked with disgust. Because I humiliated their general, or whatever he wants to call himself, back at landfall.
Ha! Bert said. Nothing like a despot who takes things personally.
The Dionys and the Crescents aren't all that different, are they?
We all want to be the last ones standing, Olam commented.
Now that's just everyone.
Bert raised his glass of whiskey.
You will have what help I can give you. The town is yours to billet your men, but, as you suggest, you shouldn't tarry. Destroy the Godstone, or make preparations to move it immediately.
Laura considered the offer for a moment, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Where was the price, or the betrayal? Was Bert seriously doing all this just to make a friend in the Nine?
You do realize that putting us up, even for a night or two, will earn the anger of the Dionys. If we leave, the town will be undefended.
I know, Bert said with a sigh. I've spent the last few years trying to take this town over by wile, to turn it into a beachhead for my country without Lindit finding out. Everything changed when the Dionys invaded, though. If they head our way, we will eject the prospectors and dynamite the passes. They might take the town, but my people will be safe up in the high places.
Even if they have privileged?
We are not undefended when it comes to sorcery.
Laura wondered what Taniel would say when she told him about this conversation. She would have to do it slowly, so she could cast his expression to memory. She stood up, putting out her hand.
We'll do our best to be gone well before the Dionys arrive.
Thank you, Bert. And I hope this is the start of a long friendship.
Chapter 56 Mikkel sat on a stool, the only piece of furniture in a looted, upscale tenement apartment on a northwest edge of the landfall plateau. His eyes were closed, his mind wandering, as he considered the options available to him from this point out. The apartment was, as far as Mikkel could tell, the nicest of Taniel's safe houses. It had tall ceilings and enormous south-facing windows in the great room, and even a master bedroom with a balcony that looked off the plateau. At some point over the last couple of months, it had been thoroughly tossed. A safe in the corner of the master bedroom had been ripped out of the wall, the furniture and silver stolen, and even the gas lines turned off and ripped out of the wall. It was the first time Mikkel had been to this particular safe house, and he was more than a little disappointed to find it in this state. But it did give him a place to think. His whole mission with the Dionys was to snatch Mara, Yggdrasia, and get her the pit out of Dionys territory. The fact that she was a privileged made this more like trying to extract a rabid bear rather than an informant. Even if she was a normal person, all his old Black Hat roots were compromised. He needed a new escape route. And he found himself less eager to use it than he had expected. The Dionys government was a viper's nest, with Sedil as the king viper ready to kill anything that moved. But part of Mikkel desperately wanted to finish what he'd started. Hunting down Black Hats had brought out a mean streak in him, a deep satisfaction at rounding up the people whom he'd helped to oppress landfall for so long. Watching the way the Dionys treated the occupied city, and especially the Palo, had deepened Mikkel's hatred of Lindit's regime. Jatura's indiscriminate bombings, his killing of women and children, these gave Mikkel a real urge to finally put him in the ground. He bounced a coin on his knee, thinking about Tenik, and wondering if Tenik and Yarit would ever forgive him for disappearing right on the eve of finally clearing landfall of the Black Hats.
Guess we'll have to find out.
Mikkel got to his feet, carrying the stool over to the corner of the great room.
He set it against the wall, using it as a stepping point to lift himself onto the gaudy trim that went around the middle of the wall. He braced one leg on a hole in the plaster where someone had torn out a gas lantern, then kicked another hole in the plaster to get him up near the ceiling. He produced a knife and began to stab through the ceiling until he hit something solid. His legs trembled from the effort of bracing himself, and the half-healed gunshot wound in his chest began to burn. He quickly cut through the ceiling plaster, and then used the handle of the knife to bash the rest of it until the ceiling finally gave way. A large metal box, about the size of two saddlebags, falling to the ground in a cloud of plaster dust. Mikel followed it down and cracked the seal on the box with his knife. He opened it cautiously, his face away from the lid, until he was sure it wasn't booby-trapped, and finally took a good look at the contents. He gave a low whistle.
"Tanya, you were really damn ready for anything, weren't you?"
Mikel found a large stable in the shadow of the plateau, a steady stream of carts moving in and out or parking in the street outside with loads of pumpkins or barrels or boxed uniforms for the Dainai's army. A sign over the door said, "Halford Hauling," and from what Mikel had heard, the old man who owned the place had made himself a fortune just since the invasion by negotiating with some quartermaster to move supplies for a Dainai's regiment. Mikel was dressed in a labourer's cotton suit, his favourite disguise, and walked straight in through the front gate of the stable with hat in hand. Dozens of workers repaired wheels, transferred cargo, or tended to horses, and no one seemed to notice him as he slipped into one of the cart parking stalls and found a young man checking equipment in the corner. The young man had thinned since Mikel saw him last, 5 or 6 months ago. His wisp of a beard was still a disgrace, and he still had that plain face of someone who could disappear into the crowd, but he moved with a purpose and confidence that he had not possessed before.
"Hello, Driston," Mikel said, leaning against the wall beside him.
Driston frowned and looked up at Mikel, blinking a few times, clearly lost in his own thoughts.
"Do I know you?"
"We only met briefly," Mikel said, "but we have met.
I heard you drive for Halford now." "That's quite a step up from where you were before the invasion."
Driston got a sort of worried look, staring at Mikel sidelong like one might a long-absent cousin who'd come looking for money.
"I think you have the wrong man."
Mikel pointed at Driston playfully.
"That I do not. The last time we saw each other, I was getting pissed at 6 o'clock in the morning in a pub in Lower Landfall."
The colour suddenly drained from Driston's face. He looked around quickly for anyone who might overhear, and he hissed at Mikel.
"But I remember you now. You're the spy you were supposed to train me."
"I am."
"Well, you listen to me. You never came looking for me, so I got a good job with Halford. And they just give me my own route, and I don't want nothing to do with anything spy business. The Black Hats are finished in this town, and I won't let you take me down with them. Hear me?"
Mikel held his hands up.
"I'm not trying to take you down with anything, Driston. I just want to hire you for a single route. I just said I won't do anything for the Black Hats."
"I'm not with the Black Hats anymore.
But I changed sides just like old Halford, and the Dainai's are making me rich. Ask around. There's plenty of gossip about a Black Hat turncoat."
Driston eyed Mikel with suspicion.
What do you want?"
"Like I said, I want to hire you. I just need someone to move a package for me."
"If you need something hauled, you go inside and talk to Halford."
"No, I won't. I want you.
I already checked your route. You're taking supplies to the front about 40 miles north of here.
It's what, a week round trip? Driston swallowed hard. Mikel continued, next time you go north, I want you to take two people with you. They can hide in your supplies, or ride up front with you, or however the pit you want to do it. Just get on past the Dionysus checkpoints with that little official card I know you carry around with you.
And what do I get in return? Are you going to blackmail me?
Not in the slightest. I'm not with the Black Hats anymore, and I've no interest in forcing you to do anything illicit.
That sounds damned illicit to me.
Mikhail gave a casual shrug.
It's more of a convenience than anything else.
He produced a heavy little bag from his pocket and thumbed four shiny yellow discs, each about the size of a coin, into one hand. They were blank, without stamp or any national marking. He tossed one to Driston, who caught it and stared for a moment before Mikhail said,
"Solid gold. Ask a jeweler if you want to confirm it. 4 now, 6 when you get your passengers past the last checkpoint. And 1 more, if you don't ask any damn questions."
Driston continued to stare at the coin.
"I could buy this whole stable with what you're offering."
"Right now," Mikhail said, "convenience is more important to me than gold. Do we have a deal?"
Driston bit the coin, muttering under his breath.
"I'm allowed to take whichever of the next 4 shipments suits me. You give me a day, and we have a deal."
Mikhail lifted one finger. "I'll have to get back to you on the day."
"You have big damn balls coming back here after storming out without an explanation the other day." Ictracia stood in her bedroom, watching Mikhail through puffy, red eyes that told him she'd either been crying or smoking Marla. By the smell, it was the latter. She wore a dressing gown and slippers, and a discarded dress on the floor told Mikhail that she'd recently returned from somewhere. Mikhail gave her his most charming smile, fingering the small bottle of chloroform wrapped in a rag in his left pocket.
"I apologize."
"I should turn you inside out." The words had no bite to them, and Mikhail wondered if maybe she had been crying. There was a defeated tone to her voice. He immediately began to worry, hoping this had nothing to do with him. Perhaps she'd just returned from another fight with her grandfather.
"I came to apologize and give you an explanation," Mikhail said.
Ictracia took a deep breath, and he waited for her to dismiss him without a word, but she let it out in a frustrated sigh instead.
"I'd like to know why you left the other day. I could have used company."
That tone was full of more hurt than Mikhail cared to plumb, and he found himself shocked by the rawness of it. He circled around her toward the window, glancing out into the street.
"Are we alone?"
"I sent the footman out to get me dinner. We have a few minutes."
"Will you promise that you won't turn me inside out until I've explained myself fully?"
Tracy's eyes narrowed. She wasn't wearing her gloves, but Mikhail didn't know if they weren't in the pockets of her dressing gown. He touched the bottle of chloroform and wondered just how stupid he really was.
"I promise," she said.
"I need to clarify something first.
Your nickname is Mara, correct?"
"It is," she said through clenched teeth.
"Is that a common nickname?"
He already knew the answer to that.
"Why would it be?" There was genuine anger in her eyes, and Mikhail moved on quickly, "only to know because I'm here for a woman named Mara." Mikhail's heart began to hammer, and he wondered if perhaps he was committing suicide. If there was even the slightest chance he was wrong, he might be dead before he could reach the door.
"Look, I didn't come to the Dionysus to get back at the Black Hats who betrayed me. I've never even worked for them. Not really.
I came to the Dionysus because my boss told me to retrieve a woman named Mara and get her out of landfall. He told me that she was in incredible danger. Hictrace's jaw tightened, and she reached into her pockets, producing her gloves. Mikkel leapt toward her, hands out front. Wait! You were in contact with a woman, probably with sorcery, until about a year ago. You spoke to her again, perhaps, he grimaced, 2 months ago? She may have warned you I was coming, she may not have, but I was sent to get you out. Ictrace's eyes wandered the room, her brow furrowing, and the gloves slipped from her fingers back into her pockets. She took several steps over to the bed and sat down, staring at her hands for a moment before looking up at Mikkel.
I shouldn't have ever answered when she spoke to me, she said softly.
But you did.
Because she seemed to know me. I told her things. Too many things, and I've betrayed my country.
This was not going well, not at all. I don't know what you told her. All I know is I was asked to get you out. Look, I had no idea you were the woman I was sent for until I overheard Sedil the other day. I've been looking in vain for Mara, only to find out I'm sharing a bed. That's why I left. I had to gather my thoughts.
I see. Ictrace's eyes focused on Mikkel. You were sent to save me.
Her voice took on an angry note that Mikkel didn't like.
That's what I was told.
From what? She demanded.
I have no idea. Danger. That's all I know.
Ictrace leaned toward him.
You have nowhere to take me. These are my people. I never told the voice in my head that I wanted to leave. I just told her I didn't want war.
Well, she thinks you're going to get killed if you stay in landfall.
And that's supposed to surprise me,
she asked flatly. Mikkel had a sudden realization that there was something going on beneath the surface that he knew nothing about. More information that Tanyel had withheld? Or something new?
My whole purpose is to die.
Did she mean as a tool of the state?
Mikkel took a half step toward her, lowering his hands until he could feel the bottle in his pocket. He grimaced inwardly. No, he was not that stupid. Beyond the danger of chloroforming a privileged, pulling shit like that would destroy any trust that had grown between them the last few days. He realized quite suddenly that he couldn't do that.
Who are you?
She asked him. The question took him off guard. He considered a dozen lies and discarded them.
You know most of it already.
I really am named Mikkel Brabis, and I really was a Black Hat Gold Rose. But I truly work for a man called the Red Hand, and I infiltrated the Blackjacks on his behalf. I was still maintaining my cover when he asked me to get you out of the city safely. My cover was blown by one of my fellow Black Hats, so I came to the Dionysus.
You're going to betray them.
Us. She laughed, bitterly. I suppose you're not betraying us if you never really were one of us. Yarit adopted you into his household. Do you know what that even means? He took a foreign spy under his wing.
Mikkel swallowed. That trust was long gone. I'm not betraying anyone. I won't steal anything. I won't kill people. I'm not even looking for information. I'm here for you.
Betrayal doesn't just involve murder, Mikkel, Ictrace said. The whole thing with you dismantling the Black Hats, it was a front.
It was.
He hesitated before continuing.
It actually felt pretty good. I've had to work with those assholes for years while they torture and subjugate my people.
Ictrace, through her anger, actually cracked a smile.
I knew you were interesting. Mikkel watched her hands, waiting for them to dip back into her pockets for her gloves. If she went for them, he might have no choice but to tackle her and try the chloroform. He really didn't want to do that.
"All of that, just to get to me," she scoffed quietly.
"I'm not leaving, Mikkel. I spoke with a voice in my head. I told her some information, sure. But I never told her I wanted to join some paleo freedom fighter off in the jungle."
Mikkel's heart began to fall. This was it. A complete failure to finish his mission and, surprisingly hurtful, the end of his relationship with Yggdrasil. He would probably be dead in a couple of minutes.
"What will you do?"
she asked. "If you refuse to come?"
"Yes."
"I'll look for the next opportunity to leave. I'm not going to force you to come with me."
She snorted, as if he could.
In a moment of bravado, Mikkel tossed her the bottle of chloroform. She caught it, looked at the label, and stared daggers at him.
"You were going to use this on me?"
"I considered it. I'm supposed to do a job, but I like you a little more than that. So, if you don't want to come, I'll just tell me boss that I couldn't find you. If you let me walk out of here, that is."
Yggdrasil passed the chloroform back and forth between her hands, then held it to the light to look at the liquid inside.
"I've heard this is unpleasant." "It's not enjoyable."
Mikkel wondered if he should make a run for it.
"Look, how about this? I stay here 3 more days. I help Yarit find that prick Jatura and put an end to the Black Hats in Landfall for good. If, at the end of those 3 days, you change your mind, I have a way for us to disappear. If not, then I'll go alone."
"I won't change my mind. These are my people, Mikkel. I have a duty to fulfill."
"Consider it."
Careful to make no sudden moves, Mikkel headed toward the door. He was out in the street before he allowed himself to breathe again. 3 days. 3 ways this could go. Either he'd get out alone, he'd get out with Yggdrasil, or she'd hand him over to be tortured to death.
What a way to live.
Chapter 57.
"We've run out of land," Jackal reported.
Stike sat in his saddle, frowning at a grassy hill on the horizon. They were a couple of days south of New Starlight and had reached the far southwest corner of the Hammer, where rolling hills of fallow fields stretched for thousands of acres in every direction, barren but for the occasional farming hamlet carving out a living in the poor soil. The farming hamlets had been abandoned since the Dainai's arrival, and they hadn't seen another soul for 2 days. Stike glanced at Ibana, who cocked an eyebrow at him and turned her horse around, and rode back down the line, checking in with officers and making sure that the whole company was still together. A few rows back and to one side, Karpol and Celine kept their horses close and spoke in Karpol's sign language, eyes on each other's hands. Stike joined them.
"We've run out of land," he told Karpol.
The bone-eye dropped her hands and stared back at him before looking toward the same grassy hill on the horizon. Beyond it were the high cliffs of the Hammer and a steep drop down to the beach, and then the narrow ocean that separated Fatrasta from Dainai's.
"Are we close?" Stike asked. "I want to find this thing and be done with it as quickly as possible. It's only a matter of time before the Dainai's army picks up our trail.
He trailed off, noticing that Karpol's eyes did not leave the horizon. Without a sign, she flipped her reins and headed toward the coast. Stike rolled his tongue along his teeth, feeling the myriad of old aches and pains that seemed to accompany every day at this age.
"Where's she going?" he asked Celine.
"I don't know."
Even Celine seemed confused, and Stike sensed that there was something wrong in the stiff way that Carpole rode. He leaned toward Jackal.
Keep a close eye on her, and a hand on your carbine.
You expect me to shoot her?
Jackal seemed surprised by this.
I don't know what to expect. These godstones are unpredictable.
He took a deep breath, trying to fill his nostrils with sorcery. But the only whiff he got was the scent of Carpole's coppery power. He waited, uncertain, for several minutes before finally heading after her. Jackal and Celine followed. They reached the clifftops, only to find that Carpole had abandoned her horse and taken a steep path down to the beach. Stike watched her pick her way through the rocks.
"Do we wait for her to come back up?"
Jackal asked.
"Maybe the thing is on the beach," Stike grunted, swinging out of the saddle.
They descended to the beach and joined Carpole on the shoreline, who was standing with her shoes discarded and her feet in the surf. The water lapped at Stike's boots, and he watched the side of her face with a growing concern. Her expression was stone-like, devoid of her usual bemusement or defiance. Her eyes seemed distant, as if she were deep in some kind of a dream. He breathed in again, trying to read her sorcery, but nothing about the coppery smell had changed. Jackal clung to the base of the cliff, watching Carpole as one might watch a rabid dog. Stike wondered if Jackal knew something he didn't. Celine kicked her shoes off and walked into the surf too, gently taking Carpole's hand. Carpole responded to the touch mechanically, her thumb gently stroking the back of Celine's wrist, and Stike suddenly felt like an invader in a private moment. He clenched his jaw, letting his irritation overwhelm his discomfort, and stepped up beside the two of them.
"What are you looking at, girl?"
he asked Carpole. Carpole's brow furrowed, and she lifted one hand and touched her thumb to her chest. Stike recognized her symbol for "I," and the hesitation that followed it.
"What is it?"
he urged. Carpole's hands moved. Celine tilted her head to the side, watching as Carpole repeated the short phrase several times in a row. Celine's face grew concerned, and she glanced quickly at Stike and then back at Carpole.
"What is she saying?"
Stike asked, his mouth suddenly dry.
It's not here," Celine translated.
Stike felt a knot form in the pit of his stomach, irritation turning to disbelief, to anger in the flash of an instant.
"What do you mean it's not here?"
Carpole spread her hands.
"I don't know."
Stike grabbed her shoulder, and she suddenly leapt away from him, stumbling through the surf and falling into a defensive stance, her passive face suddenly angry. The coppery scent grew stronger in Stike's nostrils, and he became very conscious of Celine standing between them.
"Whoa,"
he said gently, reaching out and taking Celine by the hand. He pushed her behind him, jaw tight, then set one hand on the hilt of his boss knife.
"Explain."
Carpole looked from Stike to Jackal and back again, no doubt taking note of the carbine in Jackal's hands. There was something suddenly feral in her eyes that Stike did not like, that he had not seen before. Her gaze shifted slowly to Celine, and that feral look seemed to fade. She straightened, then her hands flashed, repeating the phrase from a moment ago. Then she continued.
"It's not here," Celine translated. "I was wrong. My compass was wrong. This godstone is not in Fatrasta."
Stike resisted the urge to take a half step closer.
"Then where have you been leading us?"
"Toward the godstone."
"You just said it's not in Fatrasta."
Stike trailed off, realization setting in. He turned toward the western horizon, staring across the ocean in the direction she'd been facing when they reached the beach.
"The third Godstone is in Dionysus?"
Carpel gave a short nod. Stike thought of all the soldiers who'd died to get them here, of the lancers who'd fallen, of the new recruits who'd been butchered by a vengeful Dionysus.